The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we'll start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Brain Drain. A massive shift of federal research dollars could be underway as university researchers trade jobs following the pandemic. And the cover story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, I'm done here. Researchers, faculty members are leaving higher education. Written by Zach Ezone. After 20 years as a faculty member at Duke University, Dr. Arif Kamal decided late last year to leave academia and pursue a new opportunity. For Kamal, like thousands of others in the U.S., the pandemic offered the medical oncologist and researcher a chance to reflect on how he was spending his time and whether he could have a larger impact in a different role. So in December, Kamal became the American Cancer Society's first chief patient officer. In this role, leading the organization's patient caregiver activities, Kamal has the chance to improve cancer care at a national level. For me, the decision to leave Duke was both a combination of the opportunity and just a real itchiness about making an impact nationally and in a different way, Kamal says. Kamal wasn't alone in leaving academia for a different industry. The University of North Carolina system, for instance, experienced a sharp increase in faculty and staff turnover beginning last summer. The system's turnover rate for voluntary separations and retirements was trending around 15.5% earlier this year, up from 8.9% in previous years. For universities such as Duke and UNC Chapel Hill, losing faculty means losing important pieces of their billion-dollar research enterprises, which involve faculty members receiving funds from agencies such as the National Institutes of Health. This funding plays a critical role in the Triangle's ecosystem, as the research it supports can lead to inventions that serve as the basis for startups that spin out of universities or licensing deals with existing companies. There are various reasons influencing researchers' decisions to leave academia, some of which may be structural and others may be indicative of new opportunities in industry. For instance, Durham's Velocity Clinical Research, which operates a growing network of clinical trial sites, has seen an uptick in the number of young researchers the company is hiring with academic backgrounds. Replacing faculty members who transition out of academia can be a long process for institutions. NC State University has seen a slight uptick in faculty turnover in the last year. Catherine Stewart, the university's senior vice provost for faculty and academic affairs, says, the university is a reflection of what's happening in the workforce much more broadly, and it's unclear to most employers whether this increased churn or resorting that seems to be going on will continue to occur. It's something we're always going to be watching very carefully. Blip or trend? Turnover among university faculty and staff in North Carolina's public higher education system began to spike as the pandemic continued into last summer. Faculty and staff separations within the UNC system totaled 5,158 from July 2021 through March 2022, which with 3 months remaining in the fiscal year was already higher than previous years. The system's separations of faculty and staff ranged from 4,045 to 4,507 in the previous 4 years, according to a report from the UNC System Board of Governors May meeting. A separate report presented to the Board of Governors in April shows the system lost 585 faculty members between July 2021 and January 2022. This is more than 200 faculty members higher than the system's combined 4-year average for that 7-month period of 363. At NC State, while faculty turnover has ticked up, it remains below the national average, Stewart says. Over the 4 years prior to fiscal year 2022, when the system's increase in separations began, the university maintained an average faculty turnover rate of 2.7%, the lowest in the system, according to the April Board of Governors report. But as an institution that totaled $546.3 million in research and development expenditures in 2020, according to the National Science Foundation, losing a faculty member could mean losing their intellectual insights and connections to outside organizations. The reasons for these departures have not changed much, Stewart says, but it is an issue that concerns institutions. Chris Clemens, Provost and Chief Academic Officer at UNC Chapel Hill, acknowledges the university is also experiencing challenges in its workforce. The focus of my office since I began in February has been on finding ways to recognize and promote the success of our tremendously talented faculty and staff, Clemens says. Duke didn't respond to a request for comment on the institution's workforce situation. Nationally, other school administrators are also noticing this trend. More than half, 60% of 170 provosts who participated this year in a survey with Inside Higher Ed said turnover among faculty is somewhat higher than in previous years. Meanwhile, 19% said turnover is significantly higher, and 21% said it is either about the same or somewhat lower. To try to boost recruitment and retention within the system, state lawmakers agreed to include a 3.5% raise for all UNC system employees in the budget signed into law last year. Whether the raises, which took effect July 1, will help the situation remains to be seen. But some employees feel undervalued and undercompensated, says Kevin McClure, an associate professor at UNC Wilmington's Watson College of Education. We're certainly glad to have gotten a raise in this most recent budget, but that only gets at a small amount of many years without any kind of raise, McClure says. And then when you factor in inflation, it washes out a bit. Separate from these raises, the UNC system has implemented programs that allow institutions to offer faculty and staff sign-on and retention bonuses aimed at easing employment challenges, says Daryl Bass, Vice President of Human Resources and Chief Human Resource Officer. He says it is too soon to say how long these employment challenges could last. Updated numbers on the system's situation will be presented to the Board of Governors in October. I'm always hopeful that the numbers are going to look better, but only time will tell, Bass says. A lack of available data on the higher education workforce makes it difficult to determine whether there is a mass exodus taking place, McClure says, but it's clear that there is a lot of movement occurring at the various levels of institutions, including staff, faculty, and administrators. For instance, UNC Chapel Hill has 8 new deans this semester. McClure, earlier this year, began a project studying the workplace experiences of faculty, staff, and administrators throughout North Carolina's public university and community college systems. Through this work, McClure hopes to gather insight into what higher education employees experienced over the pandemic and provide practical recommendations that could improve recruitment and retention. This moment is going to dissipate, and if we're not seeing action on when there's at least a little bit of enthusiasm, then there's little hope for there to be action when some other crisis steals away our attention, he says. Pursuing new paths. The flow of people moving from academia to industry and vice versa has always existed, but over the last few years, the former has grown more apparent than the latter, says Dr. Ravi Parikh, an oncologist and professor at the University of Pennsylvania Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics. For a lot of people, at some point, the stresses of academia combined with the increasing awareness of opportunities in industry are going to make this trend not something that's going to go away anytime soon, Parikh says. We need to take proactive steps and not assume a correction will take place. Pay differences may play a factor, as researchers tend to make more money in the private sector than in academia. But this ignores some of the underlying issues in higher education. This includes a structure in which researchers are essentially entrepreneurs concerned with their own ability to fund their labs. This setup does not naturally lend itself to much connectedness, which can stifle innovation, Kamal says. When everyone has to watch out for how their piece of the world is funded, then it can disincentivize collaboration, Kamal says. Because if you feel like you're in a scarcity mindset, you have to hold tightly to your own things. While there are structural issues with academia that are contributing to faculty leaving, there are also factors pulling people toward industry opportunities that may not have previously existed. Dr. Youssef Zafar, a medical oncologist and researcher, largely left Duke late last year after 17 years to become the senior vice president of medical informatics at a company called Change Healthcare. In this role, Zafar will lead a new division of the health technology and data company in which he will build clinical solutions to improve patient care and outcomes. Zafar's transition to industry is not one he initially planned. It was a years-long process that was helped along by the pandemic and the subsequent widespread adoption of remote work. As Change Healthcare became a primarily virtual company, Zafar could join the company while remaining in Durham. This has allowed Zafar to maintain a small presence at Duke, where he sees patients half a day a week and maintains status as an adjunct professor, a role for which he is not paid. The ability to continue treating patients helps Zafar with his new role at Change Healthcare. Kamal has a similar arrangement with the university. This sort of approach that allows for more bi-directional movement between academia and industry could be more beneficial to both sectors in areas where they already collaborate, like clinical research, Parikh says. When you have staff that are disproportionately moving out of academia to industry, it creates a real bottleneck for both organizations to achieve their goals because we're relying on reaching others to enroll patients in trials and getting drugs to market or technology to market, Parikh says. Researcher shortage. Workforce challenges at academic medical centers have extended beyond faculty and into other areas that touch on research enterprises, which for Duke and UNC Chapel Hill have surpassed $1 billion. This includes a shortage in clinical research staff, an employee group that for academic medical centers has always been a challenge to fill, says Dr. Leisha Emmons, a professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh. Emmons is the vice president of the Society for Immunotherapy of Cancer, an organization that in August held a virtual summit to address the ongoing crisis in clinical research. This summit brought together representatives from cancer centers, contract research organizations, and government agencies to find solutions for some of the factors contributing to a slowdown in cancer drug development, including staff shortages. The clinical research shortage slows down trial timelines and delays getting drugs to patients who need them, Emmons says. There may be some drugs that get left behind because there aren't the resources to develop them. The staff shortage is partially due simply to increased demand in response to a large volume of cancer drugs in development that are increasingly becoming more complex. The staffing challenges have been exacerbated by research staff leaving academic medical centers to work with CROs, biotechs, or other companies that offer higher salaries and the potential for remote work. Paul Evans, CEO of Durham-based Velocity Clinical Research, says the company has seen a recent uptick in hiring among younger career researchers with backgrounds in academic research. This is different from the situation the company has experienced as it continues an acquisition streak of research sites in the U.S. and Europe. Many of these sites the company previously acquired were covered by physicians who were retired or conducting clinical research part-time on the side. This change, Evans says, is likely because companies such as Velocity did not previously exist. If you wanted to leave an academic post, going to a single research site doesn't necessarily look that attractive, Evans says. Outside of clinical research, university scientists are having an increasingly difficult time hiring postdoctoral fellows to work in their laboratories. These are trained professional researchers that make many of the discoveries that come out of academic institutions. When a university scientist receives a grant from an institution, like the National Institutes of Health, it includes a stipend to cover the annual salary of a postdoc fellow. In the fiscal year 2022, that amount began at $54,840 for somebody with no previous postdoc experience. But the search to fill that position is growing more difficult and can take up to a year or longer if it is ever filled, says Elisa Wahlberg, a UNC Chapel Hill professor of pathology. Wahlberg earlier this year wrote about the challenges involving postdoc recruitment in an op-ed for the American Society of Hematology. The longer the process takes, the more difficult it becomes to complete the research funded by an NIH grant, which generally lasts up to 4 years depending on the project. If hiring a postdoc fellow takes longer than a year, it can be really challenging to ensure you have the money and the people, Wahlberg says. Wahlberg, who has been at UNC Chapel Hill faculty member for 20 years, says there are various complicated issues likely contributing to the hiring challenges, such as universities not considering postdoc fellows as employees or the availability of more opportunities in private industry. This is especially true in an area like the Triangle, where there is a local ecosystem that includes life sciences companies that can offer higher salaries compared to the NIH's postdoc stipend amount. I like that there are options that will suit different people's lives in different ways, Wahlberg says. We just want to make sure those options are balanced enough so that somebody isn't excluded from an academia position if that's what they want. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we'll turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook because it's related to our cover story. The headline, Why Researchers Are Leaving College Positions. And this is written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor-in-chief of the Triangle Business Journal. A few years ago, with information from the U.S. Census Bureau and the National Institutes of Health, NIH, we reported that the Triangle was one of the regions in the world with the highest number of PhDs per capita. It offered a sense of pride for all of us, knowing there's a lot of good work being done at our universities and research consortiums, with researchers from all sectors finding the key to the next gadget or drug that would make the world a better place to live. Already, the United States is tied with European countries when it comes to being a highly educated population. About 2% of the U.S. population holds a PhD, and men are more likely than women to have a PhD in this country. But there's something happening in that field that should give us all of us pause. While it is still not at a red-hot alarming stage, reporter Zach Ezone uncovered in his centerpiece story this week that the researcher turnover rate at many universities is running higher than usual. Ezone honed in on the University of North Carolina system, where he found that the system's turnover rate for voluntary separations and retirements was trending around 15.5% earlier this year, far above the 8.9% recorded in the previous years. A separate report presented to the Board of Governors noted that the system lost 585 faculty members between July 2021 and January 2022. The UNC system is not alone in this. More and more universities across the board are losing faculty positions. The American Association of University Professors annual faculty salary survey report shows a slight 0.6% dip in overall faculty headcounts between fall 2019 and fall 2021, with bigger declines in associates and master's degree granting institutions. According to Inside Higher Ed's 2022 survey of college and university chief academic officers, 19% of provosts say faculty members are leaving at significantly higher rates than in the past. About 60% say they are leaving at somewhat higher rates. Why? For one, as Ezone's story points out, researchers are leaving universities as they are tired of bureaucracy and politics. Instead, they are going to the private sector, where they are given the resources, such as money and time, to come up with the next big thing. Companies capitalize the research through earnings releases by talking to research analysts about the potential. Stock price goes up, the market cap goes up, and the research is paid for essentially by the investors. Until, of course, we come to find out the research could not support the promise. Everything swoops down and the entire science team is let go. For public universities, especially in the Triangle, this is dangerous. That's because much of the university's basic research programs are funded by the federal government through the NIH, National Science Foundation, NASA, the Department of Defense, and a few others. Researchers almost always are able to leave with their research. That means less opportunity for universities' tech transfer arm to monetize the research. Every time a public university generates revenue through commercialization, it puts less pressure on state governments to use additional taxpayer money to finance the running of colleges. We don't know why this exodus of researchers is among us, especially right at the end of the pandemic, but we better find out quickly why. Otherwise, the bragging rights of having the smartest people on the planet right in our own backyard may be short-lived. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Art Museum displays new look. A dramatic reimagining of the North Carolina Museum of Art debuts this weekend as a cornerstone of the Triangle's cultural scene showcases and broadens its collection. The museum, backed by a strong European collection, has always been a strong regional museum, dating to when the General Assembly allotted $1 million in 1947. And the museum expanded its art and reach under longtime director Larry Wheeler, who retired in 2018. New director Valerie Hillings wanted to reorder the collection, expanding collections such as Mexico and Central America, and also displaying the works in new and creative ways. "That seemed like an opportunity for me," she says. Now, a collection has a fresh feel. In one room, a John Singleton Copley painting shares space with a silver tea set and mahogany table. In another, paintings from the 19th and early 20th century hang salon style. The Flemish works, many from the museum's beginning, are displayed to look like a room in the home in the 17th century. Despite the pandemic, Hillings says the museum remains in good shape. Its budget is north of $20 million, and about 40% of its funding comes from the General Assembly. A record 1.1 million people visited the museum and its park in 2021, and Hillings sees an opportunity to build on that with this new look. It's trying to cultivate new audiences, she says. There are a lot of new people in the area. New details on downtown's music venue. The Downtown South project is starting to be a reality, and Kane Realty Corporation's vision includes an indoor music venue that would have 3,300 seats. The 70,000-square-foot concert venue was announced September 21, and plans were filed with the City of Raleigh on September 29. The three-story building will be 4.81 acres at 130 Penmark Drive, east of I-70 and just outside of the Beltline. Site plans show the theater will have 3,000-square-foot lobby and a 10,075-square-feet of retail space. Parking will be limited as there will be less than 300 spaces. The venue is east of a central office building and a multifamily south building at Rigby and Centerline Streets and a multifamily tower on South Saunders Street. In May, Kane revealed plans for two high-rise towers, one for multifamily and one for office use, while other plans call for two mid-rise, mixed-use towers. Cary adds EV to pick up recycling. The town of Cary, which already has three Teslas in its police force, is adding battery electric-powered trucks to its joining its recycling team. The Mack LR Electric Class 8 is joining a fleet of 9 recycling vehicles and will serve as a test run for further orders, town manager Sean Siegel tells Biz. Siegel notes that the town council has really prioritized sustainability, and this is part of that effort. He credited the staff for doing homework and finding the vehicle, and more may be on the way. This one is an experiment to see how it all goes, Siegel says. The town got a $400,000 grant from the Environmental Protection Agency and is spending $500,000 of its own money. Siegel says a typical diesel truck costs about $365,000. We're really happy to have the opportunity, Siegel says. Mack Truck is as reputable a company as you can find. Cary CEO honored at New York Gala. Congratulations to Rose Lee, who recently became president and CEO of Cary's Cornerstone Building Brands, on winning the Pinnacle Award from the Asian American Business Development Center. Lee joins a group of just 30 recipients since the award began in 2004. Lee is the first female Korean-American to serve as CEO of a Fortune 1000 company. Cornerstone is the largest manufacturer of exterior building products in North America. She was honored recently at a gala in New York. Lutz stepping down at Key Nonprofit. One of the Triangle's leading nonprofit CEOs is retiring. Alice Lutz, who has led Triangle Family Services for 13 years, will step down after the organization finds her successor. Under Lutz, Triangle Family Services has seen annual revenue grow from $1.89 million to almost $6 million as it rapidly expanded services. The nonprofit, which has served local families in crisis situations since 1937, has helped more than 90,000 people during Lutz's tenure. Over my 13-year tenure as CEO, I felt a deep passion and sincere affinity for the population Triangle Family Services works with, as well as the incredible dedication of the TFS team, Lutz says. I will forever hold the work of my colleagues and our board in the very highest regard. The search committee includes a number of business leaders, including Willie Stewart of Stewart Engineering and Russ Jones of Loden Properties. And finally, IBM Red Hat joins Storage OPS. 3 years after IBM bought Red Hat in a $34 billion deal, the companies are consolidating storage businesses. IBM's move to consolidate the Red Hat storage business with Blue's own operation will mean an undisclosed number of Red Hat employees moving to IBM. IBM, which closed on its buy of Red Hat in 2019, has continually stressed Red Hat's neutrality from Big Blue. But this deal is the first major blending of the two companies, and given the way these acquisitions go, it probably won't be the last. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to our continuing series, 52 Shades of Success, Earth and Equity. The headline, Clean Cooling Comes of Age. Phononic is bringing a thermoelectric approach to refrigeration and cooling. Story by Connie Gentry. About this project, the Earth and Equity Project explores the growing awareness, actions, and accountability of businesses and leaders who face opportunities and challenges relating to environmental, social, and governance, or ESG, issues. The 52-week project will highlight what selected companies and Triangle executives are doing to address climate change, diversity, equity, inclusion, and ways to maneuver the new world of corporate responsibilities. Since day one, the plan has always been to hit the street, and rumblings of a Phononic IPO have been discussed since 2015. But now the conversation is different. Now the company has street cred in spades, and co-founder and CEO Tony Addy is eyeing Wall Street with even more conviction that what has always been inevitable, in his estimation, is gaining widespread awareness among investors and the business community. We always spoke to the inevitability of solid-state coin, believing it will do the same for the 20-year-old entrenched mechanical incumbents and cooling systems that LED lighting did in displacing the incandescent light bulb, says Addy, as he references the thermoelectric technology Phononic brings to the cooling and refrigeration industries. Addressing sustainability was not the focus when the company launched in 2008, but that's the message that has kept resonating as the product to sized solid-state solutions played out in the marketplace. The technology addresses some of the world's most demanding and pressing climate initiatives. Most notably, we don't use refrigerants. Instead, we use a mixture of carbon dioxide and water, he says. The result is a clean cooling system that, in a climate-challenged world, topples the competitive landscape, where legacy mechanical systems rely on toxic elements that produce global warming refrigerants. The world is doing an okay job with the greenhouse gases associated with emissions and combustion, but the next catastrophic battlefield is the impact of refrigerants and legacy systems, Addy says. Fatih Birol, executive director of the International Energy Agency, expressed similar sentiments in the agency's reports on clean cooling and cooling efficiencies. Growing demand for air conditioners is one of the most critical blind spots in today's energy debate, Birol stated, and a 2020 report published jointly with the United Nations Environment Program concluded, direct and indirect emissions from air conditioning and refrigeration are projected to rise 90% above 2017 levels by the year 2050. Phononic has more than 15 million devices in the market. Around 75% of its device deployments are to customers in Asia. Almost all of its cold chain tote solutions are to customers in North America. And licensing opportunities are being developed in the U.S. and Europe. Going forward, Phononic is focused on those three distinct product areas: the device business, which cools optics, telecom, fiber optic, and LiDAR systems, and emerging cold chain last mile opportunity that provides refrigeration and cooling from warehouse to table, and the expansive licensing business, where business partners license the design and Phononic sells its semiconductor product to the partner. We have a remarkable opportunity in climate control where we retrofit commercial workspaces with our technology integrated into an air handling unit in the ceiling, and the partner's larger chiller on the outside of the building handles the macro heat, Addy explains. The Phononic device handles the air conditioning on a segmented basis, and when the two systems are married, there is a tremendous savings on energy and CO2 emissions, he says. It's a clearly articulated go-to-market strategy, one with a disciplined focus that paves the way for an eventual Wall Street debut. 3 years ago, we were 8 miles wide and a quarter inch deep. Our roadmap was not governed by strategic product market fit. Our roadmap was governed by skeptics disbelieving us, and we were all over the map trying to prove a point, Addy says. One proof of capability pilot is in process via a multi-tier partnership where Phononic serves as the design innovator and component supplier for two partners, one an HVAC company that specializes in air handling systems, the other a larger, more integrated HVAC company that specializes in building management systems. Although not ready to name the partners or the installation location, Addy says laboratory-based testing has shown the Phononic solution reduced emissions by more than 30% and the combined energy consumption by almost 50%. This particular project is slated to go commercially live next year. Phononic semiconductor device is the fundamental cooling element for all of its respective solutions, whether the individual device gets integrated into communications equipment, an HVAC system, or productized into a refrigerator, freezer, or tote for its recently announced last-mile zero-emissions food delivery solution. According to an EPA report, food loss and waste in the U.S. contributed 170 million metric tons of CO2 emissions in 2021. And the Commerce Department reported that a shortage of refrigerated shipping containers drove shipping costs up an average of 50% in Q3 and Q4. You can use our cold chain solutions integrated into the vehicle to have that coldness or frozenness on demand. So in the retail warehousing last mile area, our end users are seeing ROIs in 6 to 12 months in an industry that's not used to seeing ROIs for 2 or 3 years, Adi says. And ROIs, return on investment. And now we'll read some of the top stories in the Triangle Business Journal. New downtown Raleigh hotel in the works on Blount Street, written by Laura Bromet. The hotel piece of a downtown Raleigh project by a team of local developers is officially underway. Plans have been filed with the city of Raleigh for the construction of a 138-room hotel at 415 South Blount Street. The hotel developer, Summit Hospitality, is working with Williams Realty and Building Company to bring a hotel and apartment project to the site. The hotel will be a Marriott-based Town Place Suites location. Plans show one seven-story building totaling 85,000 square feet. The hotel site is currently used as a parking lot. The developers previously announced that the hotel would include a lobby bar, expanded fitness facilities, and integrated outdoor terraces. The apartment portion of the development, situated at 414 South Person Street, is already under construction and is being marketed as the Acorn on Person Street. The building will also rise 7 stories and total 92,000 square feet. Approved plans show 4 stories of residential units, 107 in total, above 3 stories of shared structured parking. The building will be ready for occupancy mid-2023. The Acorn will feature studio, 1-bedroom and 2-bedroom units. Featured amenities include a pool, EV charging stations, and an indoor-outdoor collaborative work-from-home center. The project was first announced in November 2021 by the development pair, who expected construction on the apartments to begin in 2021, with the hotel construction beginning in 2022. The property, located 2 blocks south of Moore Square, was purchased by Chaucer Investments LLC for $3.5 million in 2018. The LLC is affiliated with Williams Realty. Before construction began, the apartment building site was vacant. Withers Ravenall is handling engineering and planning for both portions of the project, with Rob Caudill listed as the applicant for the filings. Raleigh-based Klein Design is the architect for the apartment building, and HC Architecture of Atlanta is working on the hotel portion. And our next story is written by Lauren Onasorge. The headline: firm once recognized as fastest growing company files $5 million suit. Consolidated Asset Recovery Systems files suit against former partner. A firm that once held the title of fastest growing company in the Triangle has launched a $5 million breach of contract lawsuit at a former partner. Consolidated Asset Recovery Systems, or CARS, C-A-R-S, which for years was recognized for its swift growth in the Triangle, is suing Tricolor Auto Acceptance and its affiliates, claiming it owes millions for vehicles repossessed using its software. Tricolor, through a spokesperson, declined to comment on the case. CARS develops software and services to manage the repossession and remarketing of automobiles. Tricolor provides auto loans to consumers and entered into an agreement with CARS in 2014, giving it access to its platform. CARS would manage the repossession, transportation, and auctioning of vehicles for Tricolor, and according to the lawsuit, Tricolor would pay for CARS' services on a per-vehicle basis. While defendants paid CARS' invoices from 2014 to 2022, they have systematically failed to pay most of CARS' invoices from 2020 to present, the federal lawsuit states. According to CARS' lawsuit, Tricolor entitles entities now owed more than $5 million. The lawsuit, filed by Christopher Lamb of Bradley Arendt Bolt Cummings, asked for a jury trial and an award of at least $5,052,650.98, as well as court costs and other relief. CARS, founded by Steve Norwood in 2005, was last recognized on Triangle Business Journal's Fast 50 list in 2019. Excuse me, that was the Triangle Business Journal's Fast 50 list in 2019. At the time, it was the 35th fastest growing firm in the region with 102 employees. It held the number one slot in 2015. Cars was acquired by Texas private equity firm Green Ridge Investment Partners in 2016. Norwood left the firm in 2020 and, according to his LinkedIn profile, is now CEO of Primeritus Financial Services, another firm in Green Ridge's portfolio. Major subdivision proposed in fast-growing Oxford. This is written by Evan Hoopfer. A new subdivision is in the works in Oxford, one of the hottest suburbs in the Greater Triangle. The Oxford Planning Board recently recommended that a public hearing be called for the project on November 15. The 63 acres in question sit on the west side of the city along Oxford Loop Northwest. The application lists D.R. Horton, the largest home builder in the country, as the builder. The application proposes to develop 150 single-family home lots. Three different types of D.R. Horton products are listed as part of the application. Hayden, 2,511 square feet with four bedrooms and three bathrooms. Penwell, 2,163 square feet with three to four bedrooms and two and a half baths. And Callie, 1,764 square feet with three bedrooms and two bathrooms. No other information, such as projected home price or development timeline, was included as part of the application. Oxford, which sits half an hour north of Durham along I-85, is one of the hottest small cities outside the Triangle for new investment. During one recent Oxford City Council meeting, over 800 new homes were approved. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Banking and Tech page written by Lauren Onasorge. Remote work doesn't thrill J.P. Morgan CEO. Jamie Dimon speaks in Chapel Hill, urges workers to come back. When it comes to remote work, the leader of one of the largest investment banks in the country is ready to cancel the Zoom calls. J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon, an outspoken advocate for bringing workers back to the office, told leaders in Chapel Hill September 29 that management by Hollywood Squares doesn't work well. Dimon, the keynote speaker at UNC Kenan Flagler Business School's groundbreaking event for its new building, put out a lot of one-liners, telling the crowd that while wise people learn from mistakes, the wisest learns by other people's mistakes. And one mistake might not be showing up to the office, he says. While working remotely makes sense for some jobs, Dimon said, you learn so much from people when collaborating in the same room. He said to look at who's getting ahead, who's getting the plum assignments. It's the person going into the office every day, Dimon argued. I think people should recognize the weaknesses. We make our senior people go in, he said. The remarks came as J.P. Morgan Chase continues to expand its retail branch presence in the Triangle and across North Carolina. The company opened its first retail branch in the state in Chapel Hill in 2019. Dimon sees his industry as holding a great responsibility, and that includes in promoting diversity, equity, and inclusion. He said public policy follows corporate leadership and challenged the crowd to be intentional about DEI. It's part of the mission, he said, and he sees banks as having a critical mission, particularly in downturns. What banks do is we try to lift up society, Dimon said. He encouraged UNC students to observe the world around them. A lot of the learning you're going to do is going to be not in school, he said. School is teaching you how to learn. Open up your mind, Dimon added. Don't get jazzed up by everything all the time. Lenovo pulling workers back in amid Triangle talent fight. As some firms continue to be all in when it comes to remote workers, Lenovo is reeling its employees back at least 3 days a week. Lenovo's new 3-2 policy, 3 days in the office, 2 days of flexibility, begins October 31 for nearly 5,100 Lenovo employees in the U.S. That includes the Triangle, where the Chinese computer firm maintains what it calls its dual headquarters. Lenovo's local offices have been open since April, and the firm's top local executive, Kirk Skaugen, North American site lead, says the 3-2 policy is really just a formality. Some people will love it, some people will be in the middle, and some people will not like it, he says. But at the end of the day, we needed to do the right thing for the balance of our shareholders, customers, and employees. It's not alone in taking a bet that employees will willingly return. Raleigh-based Bandwidth, for example, is requiring people to return to the office 5 days a week, a bet that comes as its new headquarters campus gets closer to fruition. But other technology firms in the Triangle have been more lenient with remote work. A Red Hat spokeswoman says the majority of its employees are designated as office flex, meaning they can choose whether to work from home or from a Red Hat office. Pendo CEO Todd Olson is still focused on flexibility too, but says, "We are encouraging individuals who are hired into hubs to visit an office on some regular cadence." And finally, why Jim Goodnight still has SaaS on path to IPO. Analytics firm SaaS Institute and Carey could still pull the trigger on an initial public offering in 2024, according to Jay Upchurch, Executive Vice President and CIO. "Obviously, we're going to be sensitive to how the markets look," Upchurch says, adding that while the timing needs to be right for such a move, SaaS has always been in the long game. "We're on track to be ready in 2024, he says. And now we turn to the On Greater Triangle Growth page written by Evan Hoopfer. Counselor, Target not cute enough. Morganton Park South will bring Target, but some concerns rise. The town of Southern Pines is making tweaks to a planned shopping complex. Plans for Morganton Park South were approved last year by the town council. The project is set to include Moore County's first Target store, in addition to other retailers, and future development phases that include hundreds of apartments and ample office space. Midland Atlantic Properties, based in Cincinnati, is developing Morganton Park South. During recent town council meetings, the developers behind Morganton Park South said some of the plans are being revised, such as there is no longer a Publix and the Target expanding from 109,000 to 147,000 square feet. During a meeting on September 7, some town council members expressed frustration at what they thought was a lack of architectural consistency with the rest of Southern Pines. Council member Ann Peterson said she didn't feel like the renderings of Target felt like they belonged in Southern Pines. "I'm just asking that it looks like it belongs here and not that it belongs in Illinois or Wisconsin or wherever this plan has been drawn from," she said during the meeting. "This is insulting. We are super cute. This is not cute." "I very much appreciate and enjoy your passion," said John Silverman of Midland Atlantic Properties in response to Peterson. "With every ounce of respect for your passion and your opinion, I disagree 100%. Silverman went on to say this Target is the nicest Target that we've ever done. In the end, Silverman agreed to make a few alterations to the plan, such as having differing roof heights across the building to make it look like it's not just one giant structure. 230-home subdivision adds new layer to town's fast growth. Another big residential project is in the works in Sanford. Last month, the Sanford City Council was scheduled to hold a public hearing on Reeves Farm, a new subdivision that would bring 233 new homes to the city. But the city's planning board did not have a quorum at the meeting, and the hearing was postponed. Reeves Farm would be spread across 46.74 acres along Wicker Street, across from Kiwanis Family Park. The applicant is Criteria Development, and the builder is Mattaby Homes, one of the largest home builders in North America. Reeves Farm is split between 162 single-family lots and 71 townhome lots and will also include a dog park, a community garden, and ponds. Mattaby Homes declined to comment on Reeves Farm. And finally, Chapel Hill firm building Hilton Hotel. Smithfield is getting a new hotel. The new Home 2 Suites by Hilton, specializing in extended stays, is planned to break ground in late spring next year and open in fall 2024, says Anup Patel, principal at Wintergreen Hospitality out of Chapel Hill. The hotel will sit just off Interstate 95 at East Market Street, right next to the Hampton Inn, which Wintergreen Hospitality also developed. Patel says that the hotel will most likely have 98 rooms and cost between $15 million and $17 million to build. Now we turn to the On Retail and Restaurants page written by Laura Bromette. Retailer to leave downtown Raleigh, House of Swank will focus on driving growing online sales. House of Swank, located at 119 East Target Street, is leaving downtown Raleigh to return to its roots. The company began by selling its custom merchandise at pop-up events, local markets, and festivals. The brand grew, and owners John Pugh and Jessica Robinson expanded into a storefront space in 2015. But in a post-pandemic world, House of Swank's first business model is more viable, Pugh says. That's why the retail store will be closing, and the brand's production will move into a warehousing space. House of Swank has been a favorite among local shoppers since the husband and wife team started the business in their two-bedroom apartment in 2011. The business first opened as a storefront at 315 South Bloodworth Street and later moved to its current spot on Harget Street. House of Swank will be gone from its store location by the end of October, Pugh says. House of Swank will be landing at the loading dock's Barrel Road location and operating out of a co-warehousing space. Merchandise will continue to be sold online as well as at pop-up events and festivals, Pugh says. The onset of the pandemic caused the online sales portion of the company's revenue to skyrocket as in-person sales dropped. That trend has continued as much of the world fell into a post-pandemic normal. While some sections of downtown Raleigh have begun to recover from the sudden departure of office workers in 2020, foot traffic by House of Swank has yet to return to its 2019 levels, Pugh says. Without a steady stream of customers, the retail location isn't practical. The current retail store is located on the ground floor of the Raleigh Furniture Building. In the building's basement, retail entrepreneur Julian Jacobs recently opened his latest concept called The Burrow. The Burrow is one of several new retail spaces to open in downtown Raleigh in recent months, though struggles remain. Weekday foot traffic has not yet reached its 2019 amount, though weekend traffic has been above its pre-pandemic levels, the Downtown Raleigh Alliance told Triangle Business Journal. Advance Auto exec leaves for Dollar Tree. Advance Auto Parts Incorporated announced the departure of Michael Creedon Jr. from his position as Executive Vice President for U.S. Stores as he joins Dollar Tree Incorporated as its Chief Operating Officer. Creedon joined Raleigh-based Advance Auto in 2013. Under Mike's leadership, we have significantly improved overall store operations and built a much stronger field team and culture. We thank him for his service and wish Mike and his family nothing but continued success as he begins his next chapter as a Chief Operating Officer, CEO Tom Grieco says. Creedon is being replaced at Advance Auto Parts by Herman Jr. Word Jr., former division president of CarQuest North America. The changes come as both retail companies deal with inflationary pressures and consumer concerns. Advance Auto recently lowered its guidance for 2020. The $11 billion company has burned through cash in 2022. Dollar Tree, based in Chesapeake, Virginia, cleared out its C-suite earlier this summer. And finally, top five auto dealer cruises into Raleigh. A Florida-based automotive retailer has filed plans with the city of Raleigh to build a dealership along Glenwood Avenue. Auto Nation ranks among the top five largest used vehicle dealers in the nation, but has yet to establish a presence in the Triangle. Its range of offerings includes new vehicles, automotive repair, and wholesale parts. The location is planned for 7523 Glenwood Avenue between Auction Direct USA and Raleigh Memorial Park Cemetery. The submitted plans depict an 18,500 square foot building with 476 inventory parking spaces and 46 customer and employee spots. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Kaylee Thompson. Developer seeking partner for project. Firm has big plans for $300 million Devereaux Meadow concept. The owners of a prime site in downtown Raleigh are looking for a partner for what's described as a potential $300 million development. Raleigh Development Company owns the 2.61-acre site on West P Street and has brought on JLL to find a partner for its high-end project that includes nine lots total. The site sits next to the future home of Devereaux Meadow Park, a 14-acre urban park slated to open in 2025. Vice President Chris Carter says Raleigh Development Company has spent 18 years assembling the site, slowly buying each of the nine parcels. The last piece was 418 West P Street, which the company acquired in late 2021 in an auction from the NC Department of Transportation for $3.76 million. The total assessed value for the property is $3.71 million. The addresses included in the project are 418 and 424 West P Street and 708, 714, 716, 722, 726, 804, and 818 Northwest Street. The total assessed value of the nine lots is $12.39 million. The location is a well-known one in Raleigh. Endless Grind, a skateboard shop that has been in business since 1986, is housed at 424 West P Street. Flight Cyclery was located in the space above Endless Grind before closing in 2016 after 17 years in business. Raleigh Development Company declined to give further details about the project as it's still in the early stages of design and planning. Conceptually, it'll be a landmark project for the city given its prominent location at the Gateway and its interaction with this park, Carter says. The property is currently under review for a rezoning request that Raleigh Development Company submitted in May. The proposal is to allow for up to 30 stories with an urban general frontage. Current zoning for the site is up to 12 stories industrial mixed use. The rezoning request will be reviewed by the Planning Commission Committee on October 25. Carter says the company is anticipating approval for the rezoning by early 2023. Luxury student housing to rise in Raleigh. Chicago-based Core Spaces recently filed new site plans with the city of Raleigh for the Hub on Campus at 1615 and 1707 Hillsborough Street next to the Alexander Family YMCA near NC State University. Plans include demolition of the shuttered Doubletree by Hilton Hotel, long known as the Brownstone Hotel, and construction of a 12-story building with a parking deck and amenities. Site plans show the student housing will have 663 units. The building will total more than 1 million square feet. The student housing community will include a fenced-in dog run, a courtyard, urban plaza, and private patios. A cost and timeline for the project wasn't immediately available from Core Spaces. Core Spaces bought the 3.58-acre property on Hillsborough Street for $42 million from Raleigh Hotel Associates, LLC, an affiliate of Virginia-based Southerly Hotels, Incorporated. The original hotel was built in 1966. Maryland developer eyes Knightdale. Natelli Communities, a residential and mixed-use developer based in Maryland, recently submitted new site plans for a 188-acre mixed-use development to the town of Knightdale. Robertson Crossing would include more than 650 single-family detached homes and townhouses. The property is an assemblage of seven lots at 840 Robertson Street on Yates Circle, 1128 Massey Farm Road, and portions of two other lots on 1050 Robertson Street and 1100 Massey Farm Road. The lots are currently zoned Rural Transition and General Residential 3. The proposed zoning is General Residential 8 and Commercial Mixed Use Planning Planned Unit Development. And now we turn to the On Healthcare and Higher Ed page written by Zach Ezone. Idera Pharma buys Durham's Asaragen. Durham CEO now leads public company after acquisition. A Durham drug developer has combined with a public company a little more than a year after launching. Idera Pharmaceuticals, based in Pennsylvania, has acquired Asaragen in a stock-for-stock deal announced September 28. The transaction brings Asaragen's three clinical programs under Idera. This is an important transition for Asaragen, said John Taylor, the former Asaragen CEO who will now lead Idera. We are delighted to complement Asaragen's exciting rare disease programs and dedicated team with financial resources, corporate structure, and people from Idera, better enabling us to deliver important therapies for patients living with rare diseases, he says. The transaction follows Idera last year announcing the company would not continue a late-stage trial of its lead program after the study failed to meet a primary endpoint. At the time, Idera CEO Vincent Milano said the company would try to identify and secure new development or commercial stage assets. Earlier this year, Idera began looking at strategic alternatives. After a thorough evaluation of strategic alternatives, we and our board of directors believe this acquisition represents the highest potential value creation opportunity for Idera stockholders, Milano said. Following the acquisition, Milano is now chair of the company's board of directors. Several other former Asaragen executives will join Taylor in maintaining their respective roles or moving into new ones at Idera. This includes Chief Medical Officer Carl Krause and Chief Operating Officer Daniel Selain, while former Chief Financial Officer Andy Jordan will become Idera's Chief Strategy Officer. Idera's CFO John Kirby will continue in his role, as will Bryant Lim, Idera's Chief Business Officer and General Counsel. Idera had a team of 13 full-time employees at the end of last year, according to a securities filing. As of June, Asaragen employed a fully virtual team of 26 employees, Taylor has said. Following the acquisition, the combined company has cash on hand of about $27 million, which provides a runway into the third quarter, 2023. From now until then, the company expects to hit several clinical milestones with its clinical programs, ACG-701 and ACG-801. ICVIA drops suit against former VP following judge's ruling. ICVIA has dropped a lawsuit against an ex-employee after a setback in a separate suit against the former executive's employer. A North Carolina business court judge in September paused a lawsuit ICVIA filed in June against Circuit Clinical Solutions, a startup based in Buffalo, New York. ICVIA accused Circuit of interfering with an agreement that ICVIA had in place with a former employee that restricted her post-employment activities. In the order, Judge Adam Conrad granted Circuit's motion to stop the case from moving forward as a separate lawsuit ICVIA filed last year in Durham County Superior Court against Dana Edwards, the former executive, is worked out. About a week after Conrad's order, ICVIA filed a notice with the Durham County Superior Court to voluntarily dismiss its lawsuit against Edwards. And finally, Global Pharma acquires Cary-based startup. A global pharmaceutical company is paying $70 million upfront for a Cary startup and its lead product candidate. Delaware's Insight announced October 3 its acquisition of Valaris Therapeutics, a biopharmaceutical company centered on its development of a treatment for the disease vitiligo. Through the transaction, Insight obtains exclusive global rights to develop and commercialize Villaris's lead asset, Eromolimab, for use against vitiligo and other diseases. In addition to the upfront cash, shareholders for Valaris Therapeutics are eligible for another $310 million based on certain development and regulatory milestones, and up to an additional $1.05 billion if certain commercial milestones are met. And as we're running out of time with the Triangle Business Journal, we'll end with the Business Pulse. The question, is remote work helping or hurting your business? There were 556 responses. 51% say, our productivity has increased. 29% say, our productivity is down. And 20% say, our productivity has remained the same. And we'll go ahead and stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.